Not too long ago, there was no coming back from death, but a little electricity applied to the heart in just the right way has changed all of that. Now death has become just another serious complication. In the book Shocked, Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead, Dr. David Casserette, a highly respected researcher and professor of medicine, chronicles his exploration of the cutting edge of resuscitation and reveals just how far science has come. David Casserette is a physician, researcher, and tenured associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. Again, the new book is Shocked, Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead. David Casserette, thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
What brought you to this subject of looking at bringing back the recently dead?
Well, it was honestly a story I tell in more detail in the book's first chapter, a girl named Michelle Funk, who died, for all intents and purposes, was dead back in the 80s, had drowned, was without a pulse, without a heartbeat, not breathing for 3 hours, and somehow she came back. She was brought back from the dead and survived. And I heard about her story as I was preparing to go to medical school, and that got me fascinated with the science of resuscitation. But I'm a hospice doctor now, and so most patients I take care of have not chosen aggressive treatment. And so I really wanted to revisit that, and I wanted to find out what science has accomplished and what it could do.
Michelle Funk was just 2 years old when she fell into the creek. So what is it about, what do we know about what happened to her, and did age play a role in that?
Well, it's a great question. A lot of things probably played a role. Age, certainly. Young people tend to survive those sorts of insults better than older folks do, partly because, well, we're young, and in general, young people do better. Their brains do better in a lot of ways, in a lot of circumstances. Also, young people don't have all of the complicating illnesses like heart disease and diabetes that make it difficult to survive a cardiac arrest. But it was also a big factor, probably, was the fact that the stream that she fell into was very, very cold. This was, I recall, in the spring, I think, with a lot of snow melt and runoff in Utah. And that cold probably saved her and saved her brain.
When you decided to take this on, and let's face it, in the book's title is the word adventures, so you knew that it was going to bring you to many different places and many different scenarios.
I did, or at least I hoped it would. I really wanted to write a book that was thoughtful and that addressed real science in a legitimate way, but I also wanted to write something that was funny in places, that was entertaining, that was interesting, that people who weren't necessarily interested in end-of-life issues and CPR might want to pick up and read. I sort of wanted to make a book about CPR and resuscitation that would make for good beach reading.
And it seems as though you have achieved that. Give us a little bit of the history of resuscitation, of what we know about how this was achieved, or at least attempted, centuries ago.
Sure. Well, that question actually tells your listeners a lot. It has been attempted for centuries. We think of CPR and resuscitation and defibrillators as being a relatively recent invention, but in fact, people have been trying to revive the dead for a very, very long time. And I spend a chapter in the book walking readers through some of the more interesting and creative ways in which people were brought back from the dead, or not, the case may be, as far back as the 1700s. One of my favorite approaches to bringing back the dead was throwing cardiac arrest victims over the back of a horse and trotting that horse along. In theory, that would have, I suppose, helped the person to breathe or would have substituted for CPR. I actually, in the book, tried this myself,
right,
just to see what it would be like, and it's not something that I would recommend.
Yeah, it didn't go well for you.
No, it certainly didn't. Presumably, it would have gone better if I had started out being dead.
But a lot of those that you write about make sense of where they try to either warm you in a fire or even burying you in the snow of sort of protecting you and putting the body in some sort of state, which I guess makes sense even in today's medical world.
It makes a lot of sense, actually. I said earlier that one of the reasons why I think Michelle Funk did so well is that she fell into water that was very, very cold. And we've learned in the last 200 years that cold is protective. Back in the 18th century, 1700s, there was something known as the Russian method, somewhat ominously known as the Russian method. Victims would be buried in snow, which seems both kind of cruel and a little bit unusual. But it turns out there's a lot of good science there, that by cooling somebody's body, you decrease their metabolism. And when you decrease their metabolism, you decrease their organs' requirement for oxygen. And so normally, once our brains go out without oxygen for 5 or 10 minutes, we start to experience some brain damage. But by decreasing the requirement for oxygen, you could, in theory at least, stretch that window out to 20 minutes, 30 minutes, or in Michelle Funk's case, as long as 3 hours. So that's why cold is such a neat way to try to bring back the dead and to preserve brains. And the Russians discovered it 200 years ago.
Does that link into cryogenics and cryonics?
It's a little bit different in the sense that cryonics is taking that to very, very extreme levels. The field of cryonics is devoted to not bringing people back from the dead in the way we normally think of it, but preserving people for hundreds, potentially, of years until science evolves to the point at which whatever caused that person to die might actually be fixable and might be curable. So it's essentially the science of freezing people for very, very long periods of time.
And I guess the most recent famous case is that of Ted Williams, right?
It is, and he was cryopreserved by a company called Alcor. I actually spent a weekend at one of Alcor's conferences. I spent a weekend that I describe in detail in the book with a room full of people who are either considering or have signed up, as Ted Williams did, to be cryopreserved. They call themselves cryonauts, believe it or not. and they're hopeful, many of them, that the science of cryonics, the science of freezing people and reviving them, will ultimately help them to rejoin the living in 500 or 1,000 years.
Meanwhile, we have never done it, right? It hasn't been done yet.
To a person, no, and that's part of the problem.
Yeah.
Most of the research that we have is on small bits of people, like corneas or heart valves, and there's a bit of a difference between freezing a heart valve and freezing a person. There is, though, a frog called the American wood frog that every winter manages to go into a state of beyond hibernation. It really allows itself to freeze. Its heart stops and it turns into a little solidified statue. And then when it warms up, it restarts its heart and hops away. So at least in theory, there are examples in nature that make us think that it might be possible, but it's still a bit of a stretch.
And Walt Disney, we don't know. Is he preserved?
I'm embarrassed to admit that I wasted the better part of a weekend looking around online to answer that precise question. And as near as I can tell, he was not cryopreserved.
Because that was always the rumor, or the urban legend anyway, but then I never really knew if it was true.
As near as I can tell, it is not. I'm not sure whether to be pleased or disappointed by that news, but I don't think Walt Disney will be rejoining the living anytime soon.
Well, if it were true, it would certainly put Disney on ice into a new way of thinking, wouldn't it?
Indeed, it would.
You write about suspended animation in, speaking of Walt Disney, you write about was thought by researchers to be a way to bring back the recently dead.
It is, or maybe phrased in a slightly different way, it's a way to preserve or extend that period of time where people could remain dead. And again, it goes back to this theory that if you can only trick the body into a state something like the hibernation state that animals enter into every winter, if you could trick the body into reducing its metabolism, if you can trick it into reducing its oxygen requirements, then the period of time that your brain and other organs can survive without oxygen is longer. Decrease your metabolism by 50%, and maybe you could extend that window of time without oxygen twofold. drop it by 90%, and you can extend that window of time, at least in theory, tenfold. And so that has enormous implications for both cardiac arrest victims and drowning victims, but also soldiers who are injured on the battlefield and sometimes require 6-8 hours of transport to get to a medical facility. The researchers who are studying suspended animation face one huge problem, which is whenever I say suspended animation, you're thinking, and I'm sure all your listeners are thinking, of science fiction. That's what it sounds like.
Right.
And it is. I mean, that's the stuff of science fiction. But there is some real science, too, there that may be saving lives potentially within the next couple of years.
You have a chapter in the book entitled Crowdsourcing Resuscitation, and it reminds us of how many tools we have at our disposal right now to help resuscitate us, to bring us back to life.
We really do, and some of the biggest advances in saving people, bringing them back from the dead, haven't been cryonics or suspended animation. It's been things like training Boy Scouts in CPR. Walk into a room these days, and chances are somebody there will have had some sort of training in CPR. I tell several stories in the book of people who were brought back to life because a neighbor or, in one case, a brother, who was 9 years old at the time, saw CPR being enacted in a film, Black Hawk Down, and when his sister drowned in a pool in the backyard, remembered this film that he had seen and decided to try it for himself. Both of them now are alive and doing well, thanks to that quick-thinking bystander who had happened to watch Black Hawk Down. So those are actually some of the greatest advances. That's why, or one of the reasons why, so many people now are surviving cardiac arrest who never would have 10 or 15 years ago.
One of the things that I liked about the book is that you don't spend a lot of time, it seemed as though it wasn't a primary interest, of what was going on when the person was dead.
That was not, you're right, a focus of the book, only because it's really hard to tell what's going on when a person is dead. Although I confess I've done several radio interviews just in the last 24 hours, and the calls that I usually get are what's happening, what is the person experiencing.
Right.
And I wish I knew, but I don't.
And we probably never will, because you're dead.
Right, unless you take copious notes.
One of the things that you address in the book is what is out there, and we were talking just a moment ago about science fiction, and some of this does have a science fiction element to it, but you write very candidly about what is in the future when it comes to resuscitation, and how do you see that going over the next several decades?
That's actually been the most interesting piece of the book for me, or at least one of the most interesting pieces. I sort of imagine that compared to throwing people over the back of trotting horses, we'd pretty much gotten where we were going to go, and there really wasn't much future. It's just a question of what we're able to do now. The future, though, is really, really interesting, and I think if I had to put my money on any big advance in the next 5 or 10 years or longer, I think it would be in suspended animation. If there's a way that we could, as I said before, trick the body into shifting its metabolism into very, very, very low gear for a period of hours or potentially even days, that buys people a lot of time, people both patients but also rescuers, a lot of time to figure out what the best treatment would be. I don't think that's so far away. We're using cold now in resuscitation. There are hypothermia protocols in most emergency departments and paramedics right now, and that's really kind of a cheap, easy, relatively form of suspended animation. But there are drugs out there that are currently in various stages of clinical trials that might actually induce a state of suspended animation, which might wind up in emergency departments in the next decade, certainly. That's really exciting.
Dr. David Kasserit is the author of Shocked: Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead. The book is published by Current. David Kasserit, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. I do appreciate your time and expertise.
Thanks so much. It was my pleasure.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book is Shocked: Adventures in Bringing Back the Recently Dead. The book is published by Current. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.